How much of your tax payments this year would you like to allocate for waterboarding in Iraq, consorting with warlords in Afghanistan, or an invasion of Iran? Everywhere we turn these days, we're being encouraged to shop in a concerted and somewhat desperate effort to salvage the 2007 economy. But where does all the stuff we're buying actually come from? Today, we're going to have three guests. In the first segment, I will have Chris Hedges, author of American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Chris Hedges is refusing to pay taxes if the U.S. goes to war with Iran and the portion spent on Iraq and Afghanistan wars unless funds for these conflicts are cut off. And we'll also have Jody Evans, co-founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace. And yesterday, to commemorate the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, they launched don'tbuybush'swar.org. Later in the program, I'll be joined by Annie Leonard. She's the creator of a powerful online video, The Story of Stuff, by the folks who gave us the Matrix. And if you want to look at that while we're going through the first segment of the show, it's storyofstuff.com. Chris Hedges was a foreign correspondent for nearly two decades for the New York Times and other newspapers, and is the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, What Every Person Should Know About War, and Losing Moses on the Freeway. He is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and teaches in the Program for American Studies at Princeton University. His newest book, as I said, is American Fascists, The Christian Right, and the War in America. I will say we haven't been able to connect with Chris yet, but we do have Jody Evans, the co-founder of the International Occupation Watch Center in Iraq and of Code Pink, with, among others, Medea Benjamin. Jody's Baghdad journals are at the center of the 2003 book Twilight of Empire, and she's the co-editor with Medea Benjamin of Stop the Next War Now. Welcome, Jody Evans.
Thanks, Chris. Hi.
Okay, and I understand.
So I'm just going to report in about Chris for a minute.
Yes.
He got a last-minute request from his newspaper he writes for to do a piece, and just at this last minute got an interview with Kucinich. So if he gets off of it, he's going to call in.
Yeah.
But they scheduled it at exactly the same time, and it was the only window he can get, as we've read in the LA Weekly, how hard it is to get an interview with Kucinich.
Right. That's right. So we probably won't have Chris Hedges, and I know that you're under the weather, but we're lucky we've got you. So yesterday, you guys launched this Don't Buy Bush's War, didn't you?
Well, actually, we launched it in many cities on Sunday, which was the actual anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. And even in Boston, we had actions with our local Code Pink groups with banners that, you know, said, "Don't buy Bush's war, join the 2008 Boston Tea Party, no more money for war," you know. And they were did a march from the Boston Commons to the harbor. They did a big action for an hour in Portland, and this is all in cold, one in New York, and yesterday there was one in Los Angeles with the tall ships at the Marina Del Rey, really just to kick this off. And it was interesting that it would fall on this week where you were watching Congress totally bail on the hopes that we had for them exactly a year ago, that we had a new Congress that had been elected on Get Us Out of the War in Iraq, and we had hoped that by now we would be bringing the troops home and they would be spending the holidays with their families.
And or at least some of them, yes.
Yeah. And so what we have instead are more troops than last year in Iraq, and no sign of bringing them home. Matter of fact, there's a vote this week that even our best friends in Congress tell us will not go our way. And that's after spending a year lobbying every day in the White House, you know, in the Capitol. That's occupying Nancy Pelosi's house in San Francisco since January 3rd, getting 92 members of Congress to promise they would never vote for anything that didn't bring the troops home, and getting 177 members to vote in May that they wouldn't vote for anything except bringing the troops home. And we find ourselves this week with $70 billion going through on the omnibus funding bill.
Right.
So we're kind of left with, you know, we've done everything and we're left, you know, we're kind of thrown back on ourselves. And you know, after a year of trying to get Congress not to fund war, what does it feel like for us and activists to not fund war with our taxes? And it's an interesting response.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask you for more of the ins and outs in that. By the way, are you on a cell phone or a landline?
A landline.
Wow, it's breaking up, but maybe that's the rain.
Just a sec. Let me see if I can find another phone.
Okay, I will talk.
Okay.
So what they have proposed is that there's a pledge. You sign this pledge, and the pledge says that I will not give any more taxes to the war. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not going to pay any taxes. They sort of have a, you know, we can pretty well see how much percentage is going to the war efforts.
There's a wonderful graphic that, you know, it's very clear.
Right. And so let me see. And there's more than one website that they could be looking at, right? One is just go straight to codepinkalert.org, but there is one that's don'tbuybushswar.org as well, correct?
Correct.
And the only thing there is, you know, remember, you don't need the apostrophes or anything. Just run it all together. Don't buy Bush's war. Flesh out the proposal a little bit more. So what is, in other words, you're asking people to join you.
So this is the different twist on this. It's never been done before. First of all, we hold in our bodies and our minds that the fear of doing this has to do with going to jail, when actually laws were changed in the late 90s that lessened the power of the IRS against resistance, because it had been abusive, especially to anti-war protesters. So, you know, the end result isn't, you'd have to really push it hard to go to jail. You're resisting paying a percentage of your taxes, and we give you the option. The first option is 7%, which is the proportion of your income tax in 2008 that is spent, would be spent on the Iraq war, Iraq and Afghanistan war.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the 31%, which is the amount that's on current military expenses, and then 51% is the part of the budget that is spent on all of military expenses.
But what we're looking at here is the 7%, right?
Right.
Okay.
That's what we're inviting people to. But again, we're falling back on a personal ask. It's very personal. So, you know, some people are choosing the 7% and some people are choosing the 51%. It's a breadth. And then we give people four ways to participate. The first being to sign the pledge that says, I will not pay the percentage of my taxes that I decide, either the 7 or the 31 or the 51, on April 15th, if I'm joined by 100,000 other U.S. taxpayers in concert. So basically right now, all they're doing is signing a pledge saying, I will join with this group, meaning there's kind of a force in numbers, there's a safety in numbers, if we do it together. And the most that have been tax resistors in the last few years, it's maybe gotten to 2,000. So it would be a huge leap to get to the 100,000. But part of what keeps people from doing it is doing it alone.
Sure. And so let me just just reiterate what you said, because in case people missed it. You go to the websites, don'tbuybushswar.org or codepinkalert.org, and find the campaign Don't Buy Bush's War. Then if you sign up, all you're saying, or what you're saying, is you pledge that when 100,000 people have signed the pledge, so when 99,999 join you, then the pledge kicks in. And if it doesn't reach that large number, then you've made the pledge in good conscience, but you're not bound to do it by that pledge.
Right, and some people will and some people won't.
Exactly.
And so the second option is, having, you know, kind of started with this, we see that there's many people, you know, that of good conscience and who deeply oppose the Bush administration, who are just not ready to make this leap. And so we give them an opportunity to give us the interest on the 7% they would have been paying, which is really the cost of doing this action, to, you know, their favorite peace organization, to Don't Buy Bush's War, to help do outreach, to something that helps this move further, so that if they don't want to do the act of actually not paying their taxes, there's a way to help nourish this act, this campaign, so that it will grow.
Okay.
Then the other option is that they don't need to wait for the 100,000 people. That right now, that they are so upset that they're ready to join the tax boycott now. We send them to the 2008 war tax boycott, which is a coalition of all the past war tax resistor organizations, and they can sign up with them right now. And then the other fourth option is when they're signing the pledge, they also click and say, if we invade Iran, I'm going to join Chris Hedges and not pay my taxes if we invade Iran.
I see. And that was the 100% of your taxes, right? That was like in protest
right.
to another illegal war.
Oh, yes. We're very partnered together, and it's a large coalition that's continuing to grow as, you know, each group kind of
finds out about each other, really, isn't
through,
it?
And yeah. worries through their, you know, the risk of this. What's interesting is that this, you know, this has happened since almost 1,000 years. You can go back in history where tax resistance has happened around war. But here we are, you know, in the fifth year of this activism, and it's still only 2,000 people. So it was really an opportunity to say, you know, here is a personal way to get engaged, especially up against what we're against with Bush, who is just Teflon to anything we do in the streets.
Right, right.
And now, so that was that. We had Bush.
Let me just say something, as I've mentioned before on the air, is that when people say, well, you know, demonstrate, don't demonstrate, you know, do I go out to the streets? I mean, I do remember that prior to the invasion, millions went in the streets, and he said basically it didn't matter a bit to him. Now this, you also quote in one of the things I've read, you quote Alexander Haig, former Secretary of State and former head of the National Security Council and a general, former general. And he said, this is during Vietnam, let them march all they want as long as they pay their taxes.
Right.
So this is hitting, this is it. And what we hoped was that when we elected the Democratic Congress in 06, I think the mandate from the people was find a way to stop this war. And the way that the Congress should be able to stop it is by stopping the funding. They won't. So this gives people an individual opportunity to do so themselves.
Well, and actually, you know, most people that are doing it have phoned. They've, you know, gone to Washington. They've done actions outside of offices. You know, they've done everything that you can do. And now that what we see this week is that Congress is just lost in a fog of war and fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it really does fall back on us. And, you know, one of the things people ask is, well, how effective is this going to be? And the effectiveness of it is that we really have to come back to the place where we're committed to something and where we won't allow something to happen, which is what we were asking of Congress. And for each of us to do an act that says, I won't fund this war, really brings it back to home. And you really have to look at yourself and see, well, wow, Congress had to go through that fear and they couldn't come over it. You know, what's the worst that can happen is basically you pay a 7% interest and a penalty, which the penalties have been lessened after 89. And, you know, what do you do to go to Washington or, you know, be out in action? It's but yet it's the strongest form of activism. Says, I will no longer be complicit.
That's right. Not in my name, not with my dollars. I'm going to let you go, Jody, and I'm going to quote a quote that you quote. When Ralph Waldo Emerson visited Thoreau, who was in jail, staging civil disobedience, he asked the author of Walden, Henry, what are you doing in there? To which Thoreau responded, Ralph, what are you doing out there? And so to all of us and to everyone who's listening, what are we doing out here?
We hope you can join with us.
Okay, so it's codepinkalert.org and don'tbuybushswar.org. Thank you, Jody Evans. Have wonderful holidays.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to bring in Annie Leonard. Annie Leonard has produced one of those videos that has become wonderfully viral. And before I called her, I got emails from 3, 4, 5 different people saying, some saying, check out this video. The others saying, have her on your show. And Annie Land is an expert in international sustainability and environmental health issues for more than 20 years. She's been investigating factories and dumps around the world. She's coordinator of the Funders Work Group for Sustainable Production and Consumption. She's worked with a number of global groups around the world on these issues, and she's the force behind The Story of Stuff, which you can find at storyofstuff.com. Welcome, Annie Leonard.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Very well. This is not the kind of work you've done before. You've been, as I read your biography, all over the globe, you know, trying many forms of work in this direction. What led you to this action?
You mean to making the actual film?
Exactly.
Well, I am fortunate enough to have been able to spend literally 20 years visiting factories where our stuff is made and dumps where our stuff is dumped all over the world. And doing that has sort of created this kind of social neurosis that I have where I cannot hold an item without imagining its upstream and downstream life, where it came from and where it's going. And going through life in this way is actually incredibly illuminating. So I wanted other people to join me in having...
In your neurosis.
Yes, exactly. So I would be less lonely. I wanted other people to join me in thinking about where all this stuff in our life comes from, where it goes, and how we, as well as communities on the other side of the world, are paying the price for this excessive consumerism that we're experiencing.
Okay. And, of course, you are bringing this out at the peak of consumerism in the Christmas buying frenzy and so on. Before we go into actually the content and the ideas, tell me what the response has been. As I told you, I've gotten many emails from friends signaling me there. What's been the response in terms of number of views, all this sort of thing?
I have to say, the response is amazing. I feel in a lot of ways that we've sort of taken the temperature of the world and seeing that a lot of people are equally fed up with this consumer mania. As of today, or actually as of last night, over 500,000 views have happened online, watching the movie online, from all over the world. I mean, literally from like 200 countries all over the world. As well, a lot of local screenings have happened. There's been screenings in Asia, in Africa, in Europe, in the United States. I'm getting about 200 emails a day from teachers who want to use it and church groups and individuals, and, you know, 98% of them are just amazingly positive, where people are saying, you know, great, let's have this discussion.
Okay, and so now tell people a bit about it. First of all, how long is it?
It's a 20-minute film, but
okay.
It's really fast. I don't even take a breath.
I know. So I just want people to know that you know, when you're used to running up to YouTube to see something that runs a minute and a half, or, you know, the last funny clip from The Daily Show, may the strike end someday, you know, this is 20 minutes, so be ready to give it some time, but it's enormously full, and as she says, she doesn't stop for a minute. And what's the message?
The message is a number of things. One is that there's a cost to this excessive consumption. There's an environmental cost, there's a social cost, and there's a personal happiness cost. This is what's really interesting. A lot of people think buying all this stuff is making us happier, but recent data has come out shown that it's not making us happier. So we're trashing the planet, we're trashing communities, and we're not even having fun. I mean, if we were at least having fun, we might want to reconsider, but it's not even fun anymore. So we need to rethink how we make, use, and relate to stuff in our
society. Let me ask you quickly about that fun thing. I had Bill McKibben on around Earth Day last year about his new book, Deep Economy, and he was looking just at the United States, but in the United States, he said, yeah, that the happiest we ever showed up on surveys was in the mid-50s, and that we are much less happy now. His analysis was that the loss of community cannot be made up for by the gain in material goods. Is this a global phenomenon?
It's increasingly global as, you know, we export our waste, we export our dirty technologies, but I'd say the most dangerous thing that we export is this way of living.
This appetite, yeah.
And so as other countries get on board the throwaway disposable, you know, consumption above all mentality, they're seeing a erosion of their communities, of their social fabric, of their civic life, which then leads to increasing social isolation and loneliness.
And let me ask, did you do any research over the years or in the origins of this piece in how little people know about where stuff comes from?
I didn't do any particular research on that except for just talking to everybody I know, you know, for 20 years.
to the point of being sort of a point of ridicule among all my friends, that I'm constantly grilling them. And what I find is that most people don't think about the upstream or downstream life of their products, and they're certainly not going to get that information from the mainstream media. That's one of the things this film talks about, is that the mainstream media not only encourages us to buy by bombarding us with advertisements, but by hiding the true life cycle and true impacts of all this stuff we're buying.
Okay, so we're talking with Annie Leonard, creator of a 20-minute video called The Story of Stuff. You can watch it, and I recommend you do, at thestoryofstuff.org or .com or both.
Either one.
Either one. Very good for you. Okay, pick an object. And first of all, one thing that I noticed is you use the term upstream and downstream. First, explain what those mean, and then pick an object and tell some of the grisly facts.
Absolutely. Upstream basically means the production, the extraction and production, the item's life before it got into your hands. And then downstream means where it's going afterwards, the dump or the incinerator or the third world village, wherever it's going to end up when you chuck it out in the garbage or recycling bin. So the upstream and downstream life of a product together means its whole life.
Mm-hmm. And we see it while we're holding on to it, but as you say, the worst effects on the environment, of course, happen before and after. So pick a product and tell me...
Let's pick an electronic. Let's pick an iPod or a little radio or something.
Okay, one that probably many people are either going to get for Christmas, give for Christmas, or are thinking about. Okay, an iPod.
Okay, so these kinds of little electronic gadgets have materials from all over the world. They have toxic chemicals that are produced in some factory where the workers in the host community were likely contaminated with these things. They have metals, which means that there had to be mining happening and all kinds of disastrous practices with mining. They have plastics, which means they're connected to oil drilling. Some of the social disruption of these electronics components are really huge, especially coltan. Coltan is a metal that's mined in the Congo, and it's used for our cheap and disposable electronics. And it's been the mining and selling of coltan has been linked to funding civil war in the Congo. So from environmental health impacts to pollution of water to actual civil war, there's a whole variety of negative environmental and social impacts associated with getting and making the stuff that goes in the electronics.
Not to get too specifically nerdy here, but are you talking about Democratic Republic of Congo?
Yes.
Okay, so folks, if you want to really see a grisly civil war, that is one of the grisliest things going on in the world, with about as much... rape of women as we've ever seen as a weapon of war. And so what you're saying is part of that is being funded by materials that are used in your iPod.
That's right. Then here's a real interesting thing about the iPods or all these electronics. They are loaded with toxic chemicals, and that means the production of them is toxic, and it means the disposal of them is toxic. But the European Union has recently passed legislation to get those toxic chemicals out of electronics. So if you buy an iPod or a stick of lipstick or a sunscreen or a whole variety of other things in Europe, you're not going to have these toxic chemicals. But if you buy it here, you are going to have it. So that's a piece where the governance and democracy comes in. Why is it that the European governments are protecting their citizens more than our own governments protecting us?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, a term that people, if you've heard it on this show before, precautionary principle, in Europe, it's not universal, but there is a leaning toward this notion that something, a product or a new chemical process or a new extraction process, is guilty until proven innocent. In other words, we've gotten along without it so far. Prove that it's safe before we start using it. In the U.S., they've never been willing, except maybe on community level, to go with that. In the U.S., it's usually any convenience, any advance, so-called, is good until proven harmful, until you can prove people have been harmfully affected by it. And sometimes that harmful effect might be cumulative, might take 5-10 years, might only happen to infants in the womb. And so the chances of that ever being sufficiently cited are small.
Absolutely.
So again, the video is The Story of Stuff. The site is storyofstuff.com or storyofstuff.org. And you can go to codepinkalert.org or don'tbuybushswar.org to learn more about the campaign to withhold taxes that pay for the war. Thank you, Annie Leonard. Thank you, G. Keep up the good work.